I'm Leonard Nimoy, and we're going to be talking here about Star Trek III, which I directed and was the first feature that I ever directed. At the end of the previous movie, at the end of Star Trek II, what had happened was that the Enterprise is in mortal danger. Khan has set off an explosive device which is going to blow us into Kingdom Come. The Enterprise is hobbling away, can't get away fast enough because there's been some damage done in the engine room. Spock sacrifices himself.
And prosper.
We are assembled here today to pay final respects.
And we go from there. Now, Harv Bennett came to me. He was the producer of Star Trek II, and said, what can you do in this scene that will give us some thread for a future story if there ever is going to be anything having to do with Spock in the future? Give us something to hold on to. So I came up with the idea of doing a mind meld on Dr. McCoy, in which I simply said one word. I said, remember. I felt that was vague enough and ambiguous enough that it could be interpreted in a number of different ways, and maybe that would be a thread in another story.
This was the most.
We did not really have a plan to bring Spock back at that time. That evolved later when the studio came to me and said, we'd like to do another movie. We'd like to have Spock come back. We'd like you to be involved in the movie. What would you like to do? And I said, I'd like to direct it. And that led to a series of meetings and discussions, which were halted temporarily by the fact that the studio administration, Michael Eisner, who was head of Paramount at the time, really was under the impression that I had insisted that Spock be killed off, that I didn't want to do Spock anymore. And it was in my contract in Star Trek II that Spock had to die, which was not true. It was a rumor that was floated about in the press, and believe it or not, the Paramount executives believed it. When they discovered that was not true, I was given the mandate to make Star Trek III, and that's how the job came about. And then it became a question of finding a way to pick up those threads, to find a way to extend the sort of afterlife of Spock into this movie, that in some credible way he had something of him had survived and could be found and saved. And that's how the movie began. There was a conscious design to make these two pictures fit together as a continuation of story. And in fact, for that matter, when this picture was finished, the same thing was done with Star Trek IV. So we realized at some point that we had created a trilogy unintentionally. Nobody said, let's do a three-part story here with three films. It just worked out that way, and I think it worked out very well. More than a visual style, I was concerned with the emotional design of this movie. I wanted it eventually to be operatic. I wanted the emotions to be very large, very broad, life and death themes, death and resurrection themes, and the look of the picture, the performances, the music, everything about it, to rise to that occasion, to rise to large sizes, sizable characters playing out a large story on a large canvas. Christopher Lloyd was extremely helpful in that respect. I thought he brought a tremendous amount of theatricality to the character, the Klingon. And James Horner, very good. Very good. He did a great job. Poignant at times. Soaring at times. Devastatingly painful at times. Big, big emotions. Big emotions.
Hi, I'm Harv Bennett. My role, I guess, is creative supervisor. Chief of staff, I often say. The first thing I was confronted with in writing the script was, what about those people who hadn't seen Wrath of Khan? Well, in one sense, that was a pointless concern, because those who would come to Star Trek III undoubtedly had seen Star Trek II, but I could not assume that. Also, I was hoping that if we had X million people for the first for Star Trek II, we'd get newcomers for this one, and they wouldn't have seen the first one. In any event, once again, my television mentality won out. In television, to this day, you recap that which was critical in the plot of the week before. Previously in Star Trek. And so, reflexively, I reached for the previously in Star Trek film device. And that's how we did it. In addition to that, I needed something that, as far as I could remember, had never been done in the series. And that was Kirk directly narrating.
Most of our battle damage repaired, we're almost home. Yet I feel uneasy. And I wonder why.
Captain's log, stardate 57342. We were on our way to our always official reports. There were medical logs, there were first officers' logs, but it was always impersonal. Data. I needed the man to say how he felt. I needed the man to tell us a story about feelings and loss. The captain's personal log also allowed us to set the depth of Kirk's feelings in silence. That is, he's not declaiming these feelings or playing them. We know them. And when we come to the crisis of the life form in Spock's cabin, and everyone is saying, what's going on, what's going on, he is as absorbed as the rest of the crew.
Yes, sir.
We know that from the personal log. And yet, as is human, you say,
no, sir.
Why are you all so obsessed about Spock? He certainly is as obsessed as anyone. Okay, go ahead, you know. We'll check it out. All right. And then he gets another piece of information and says, I'm on my way.
Timing is excellent, Mr. Scott.
Without that narration, he would have looked like a very energyless actor walking around the set looking beat up.
You don't have 8 weeks, so I'll do it for you in two.
Mr. Scott, have you always multiplied your repair estimates by a factor of four?
Certainly, sir.
The Enterprise was in pain at the beginning of this movie, as was the crew. The crew had suffered the loss of Spock. Kirk is particularly unhappy and depressed about that. Somber. The movie opens in a very somber way. And the ship is somber. There's a minimal crew on board. It's a different look at the Enterprise in that sense. Different look at the Enterprise and the crew. The picture opens very moody and very thoughtful.
Well, God knows it should be. This time we've paid for the party with our dearest blood.
I had been writing about heroes in television for so long, and I never thought of myself as a science fiction writer. My writing, for good or bad, is very plot-oriented, as befits a television writer. You're under time limitations, you have so much story to tell, and of course in television you also have a franchise to keep alive, so you have to be very, very specific about your adventures and where they take you.
Keep scanning.
In Star Trek III, I set out to write an adventure film,
where the hell is he?
Knowing where I was going and knowing peripherally what huge issues I was going to be able to deal with and against what odds. It was only as I was writing it that, for example, Genesis became synonymous in my mind with the atomic struggle that we all lived through. It was only as I was writing it that I realized the Klingons were as dastardly a group of heavies, and that I had made them so, resurrected them from the series where they were ill-defined or non-defined. Could have chosen the Romulans. But from my experience seeing all the episodes, I'd never gotten that sense of determination and absolutism that the Klingon episodes reveal.
Jumpy et pip. Coop badly, a toot badge.
Well, we're looking for a way to dramatize this thing, to make it accessible, to make it understandable, to bring some emotional impact to it. So it's not just information. We're trying to avoid just simply putting out information. We're trying to create intrigue and drama, and to have this lady of stature, lady of character and presence, in a relationship with this guy who's going to become our nemesis in this movie, I thought was very interesting and helpful in establishing the context in which the story is going to take place. And that she is sacrificed by him. She has to go. Okay, let's go about our business and destroy her and the ship. much as they care about each other, she knows too much. She saw something or heard something that she shouldn't have heard. Finished. That teaches us something about the Klingon mentality. They'll destroy each other if necessary because of their paranoia and their need for secrecy and control. Your brother gets in the way, your brother learns something he shouldn't learn, your brother dies. That's the Klingon mentality that we were dealing with here.
That's so gross.
So he's wiped her out and he's destroyed the ship. He says, okay, that's done, new course. And by the way, feed my pet. My thrust always was, let's learn something. I think that's at the best of Star Trek, always. Let's get under the skin of these characters, under the skin of their story, under the skin of their society. Why are they so paranoid and why are they so angry and hostile?
One of the tasks I felt important in Star Trek II was the passage of time between the series and the new films. As you remember, age was a thematic undertone for all the characters. We didn't want to present them anymore as gauzed-in versions of the past. Along with that, it was obvious we had to move along in terms of the passage of time. Now, what happens? Enterprise becomes obsolescent. In 20 years, even today, fighter planes and bombers become things of yesterday with rare exceptions. And Enterprise has been plowing through space since 1966. Well, that's a long time to the time of this film. And as said eloquently by Robert Hooks, the Enterprise is 20 years old. We think her day is done. To illustrate that, we had to evolve what might be the next generation of spacecraft. We had to give it, obviously, a look, which the ILM people did rather well. We also had to give it capabilities. And the one capability that was critical to us was transwarp drive, whatever that meant. We could call it anything because we knew we were going to foul up the machinery. But it had to be something that made us look a little slower, a little older. And the next generation was beginning to push the Star Trek franchise and cast towards what? Growth or retirement?
Stand by umbilical and gravitational support systems.
We had some work to do with getting the Enterprise and getting the ship back into focus because I thought that the first movie, for very good and obvious reasons, I felt that a mistake had been made in over-generously playing the ship, and getting the ship in position improperly, as though the movie was about the ship. It wasn't about the ship. It has to be about the people. But the ship has to play a role, has to be a character, and in this case, a wounded character. And we have to have some empathy for that. And it's a question of finding the proper balance.
The door to Spock's quarters has been forced.
I'm on my way. Sulu, continue docking procedure.
Aye, sir.
Yanni Sumashichi.
Huh?
Nu vot.
I wasn't comfortable with the way Spock's quarters looked, and I wanted to redesign and redevelop it. This was a challenging scene to me. This is the ghost scene, sort of. I think of it as a ghost scene. There's a ghost in this room, the ghost of Spock. And to get that cooking was the whole point, was to get the idea that there's something spooky going on here, something scary and spooky, something unexplained. And Bill plays that here. He plays that, what is this? What's going on? What am I hearing? What am I seeing? And off in the dark there is this figure sitting there. Is that Spock? My God. Sounds like him. Who's sitting there talking?
Help me. Bones. What the hell are you doing? Have you lost your mind? Help me, you. Take me home.
It's got to be played sincerely and with some doubt and wonder, and just in the same way that the audience would doubt and wonder. You can't let the audience be ahead of you here, thinking, oh, no, come on, don't kid me, you know. And then, of course, there was a job for D. Kelly to do here, which was to be Dr. McCoy expressing Spock, manifesting Spock in a way that we think something strange going on here. So the mystery is established. And now it's time to start peeling away layers of the onion to try to understand what the mystery is, what's at the heart of it, what's at the core of it.
Docking is completed. Starfleet Commander Morrow is on his way for inspection.
Uhura, get the medics down here. Get them now.
Very tough. You hope that the charm of the acting and that the story will hold up. These are not exactly action sequences. And for audiences that have been trained to expect a lot of movement, action, violence, shooting, and so forth, they're tricky. But they have to be done in some way at some time. And there's a certain economy in doing this, too, as opposed to playing it in action while they're in motion running around the ship or where they're in the station itself. You've got the sets here. They're already paid for and built. Let's use them. So you're stuck with trying to make these expositional scenes come to life with performance.
I'm sorry, Mr. Scott, but there will be no refit.
Admiral, I don't understand. The Enterprise is not...
Jim, the Enterprise is 20 years old. We feel her day is over.
But we had requested.
And the idea here is to give some sense that the Federation is not exactly being friendly and understanding and sympathetic to Kirk and his crew. They've lost one of their dearest friends in Spock, and the Enterprise is beat up, and they come home to this kind of ignominious reception. So we are developing the idea of the Renegade, the idea that that Kirk and crew will decide that they will take matters into their own hands when they see an opportunity to go out and do something positive.
To fully understand the events on which I report, it is necessary to review the theoretical data on the Genesis device. As developed by Doctors Carroll and David Marcus, Genesis, simply put, is life from lifelessness. It was the intention to introduce the Genesis device into a pre-selected area of a lifeless space body.
It's the same footage. Again, that's a matter of good storytelling and economy. You've got that interesting footage. Let's find a way to use it here to help move the story along.
A living, breathing planet now exists, capable of sustaining whatever life forms we see fit to deposit on it.
So, got John Larroquette on the right here, playing sort of the thoughtful Klingon. Klingon who's inclined to be somewhat liberal in his thinking, and not quite the total dedicated fascist that the rest of them are.
Impressive. They can make planets.
Oh, yes. New cities, homes in the country. Your woman at your side, children playing at your feet. And overhead, fluttering in the breeze, the flag of the Federation. Charming.
Chris Lloyd.
Station.
We interviewed a lot of actors, and he came in, and I always admired his work, particularly on Taxi, and I admired him all the way back to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was such a wonderful presence, and I always knew he was a very good actor. But what he really did for me when he came in was show me how totally chameleon-like he is. When he came in and read this role, he was totally unlike anything I'd ever seen him do before, and I was just swept away by his ability to transform himself so completely and to give us this wonderful... wonderful, powerful character. And boy, I went to bat to hire him on the spot.
We have reached the destination planet at point 035.
Very well, Lieutenant.
The sense was the Enterprise is the real thing. The rest of them are sort of, you know, poor imitations. I think the whole idea was to sort of make fun and make light of this other ship, this wonderful advanced ship, and put it sort of in competition with the Enterprise, which was the grand old lady who was still tough and durable and feisty. The whole idea was to make this new ship be sort of effete and therefore sort of ridiculous and to make fun of it. And probably that's the reason for the pink chairs.
Just like your father. So human. All units functional. Recorders are on. Scanning sector...
Hi, I'm Robin Curtis, and Star Trek III introduced me as Lieutenant Savick. When I first moved to California, to Los Angeles, my manager at the time set me up with all kinds of wonderful interviews with the casting departments at the various studios, and one of the people that I met at that time, I believe this was spring of 82, was a lovely woman by the name of Elsa Bergeron, and she was there at the Paramount casting department. During our meeting, we really connected. However, a year went by before a project came across her desk that she thought I was right for, and that project happened to be Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. So later I was called back to meet Leonard Nimoy. And this meeting was unusual in many respects, but one in particular was that he met with me one-on-one, and he engendered a very comfortable meeting, a meeting where I felt very forthcoming. You know, we were able to, I think, accomplish something in the brief time we spent together, and a part of that time was spent reviewing the material. He explained to me what this character, who this character was, and what the backstory was a little bit so that I would understand what it was I was talking about. And then he said, "Do you mind if I tape it?" And I said, "No." And so there took place a lovely exchange of scenes. We did the scenes together. He directed me. He got it all on tape. And what that did was that saved me from having to go and repeat my performance, which is, again, another sort of very tense experience for actors when you have to go to a second callback and a third callback and hopefully recreate whatever it was that you offered up the first time. I don't think that I met anyone again until I screen tested almost maybe 6 to 8 weeks later. And that almost felt like just a matter of exercise. Like, let's have fun now. Let's see what this character might look like if you were to play her, because, you know, we think you're going to play her, kind of thing. You know, that's what it felt like that day. And then I was called, I believe, the next day that I got the part, and this was absolutely a very thrilling moment.
Stand and wait.
Sir, about Dr. McCoy, how is he?
It's good news. He's home, resting comfortably. Pump full of tranquilizers. They say it's exhaustion. He promised me he'd stay put. Well, we'll see. Ah, Mr. Scott. Come. Sarek. Ambassador, I had no idea you were here. I believe you know my crew.
The heritage of the series gave us the Romulans, it gave us the Klingons, and it gave us the Vulcans, Spock's planet and culture of origin. We know that Spock has green blood. We know that Romulans have been antagonists. We know that Klingons have been antagonists. Yet there is always a hint that there's been a peace treaty and there is a neutral zone. And these are the spatial elements that we inherit when we're dealing with this.
Only his body was in death.
We needed to define good guys and bad guys here. Leonard, who in the original series probably did more to create the Vulcan culture and the Vulcan mysticism, he became the reigning authority on such things. I always like to call him a volcanologist, if that isn't somebody who deals with volcanoes. In any event, Leonard wanted to explore his own heritage, acting-wise, as a Vulcan. He began referring us back to other episodes. He defined the Katra for me to write, for him to direct. And I began to get a much clearer picture of what was only covered lightly in the series.
I must have your thoughts. May I join your mind?
Certainly.
You spoke of your friendship.
The mind melt started with a brilliant stroke of writing by Gene Roddenberry. There was a scene in one of the episodes, and I have frankly forgotten what the title of it was. There was a scene where we had brought on board a man who was a lunatic, who was an escapee from an asylum or something, whatever. He was a deranged character. He had information that we needed. And in a sick bay scene that had been written, there was this lengthy interrogation of him where we piecemeal got him to say a word at a time, which we pieced together, and that gave us the answer to the puzzle so we could go off on the adventure and figure out how to solve a problem. And Gene rewrote that entire scene, making it, instead of a verbal interrogation, made it a mental interrogation, made it a mind melt. He created this idea that Spock could get in touch with this man's brain. And in that scene, it was made manifest that it was a dangerous thing for Spock to do because he had to join with this person's mind. And if this person being deranged, his mind could injure Spock's mind because they were going to be conjoined during this period of time. So there was that drama going on where Spock says, I'll do this. Spock is dangerous, yes, but it has to be done. I'll do it. And Spock goes in and extracts the information from this mind. And that was the beginning of the mind meld. Later, the writers began to play a little bit more fast and loose with it, you know, and let Spock do it at will. But originally, it was intended to be a very dangerous and difficult process.
Everything he knew is lost. Please wait. He would have found a way if there was that much at stake. Spock would have found a way.
Yes. But how?
What if he joined with someone else?
The question was, what did Spock give McCoy in that mind meld? What did he give him? What did he implant in McCoy's being or brain that we could pick up on and say, okay, there's a thread there someplace, there's something alive, let's find out what it is. So we said, okay, the body has died. If the body has died and been shot off into space and landed on the Genesis planet, what about his being? What about his brain? What about his mind? What about all that intellect? Where did it all go? So we devised this idea. We just concocted this idea that this whole thing called the Catra, which we described as everything that was not of the body. That was the sort of the catchphrase to describe it. Everything that, what is the Catra? It's everything that is not of the body. It's his spirit, it's his will, it's his essence, it's his being, it's his thoughts, it's everything, except the body itself. So McCoy is carrying that, and we'll call it Catra. And McCoy is carrying that. When we discover that, we understand what has to be done. The Catra is, the body is there. We know where the body is. Now we've got to go and bring to the body the rest of him, so that we can put Humpty Dumpty back together again, so to speak. You know, that was the whole idea.
In pain.
What must I do?
You must bring them to Mount Silea on Vulcan. Only there can both find peace.
What you ask is difficult.
You will find a way, Kirk.
There's an awful lot of Vulcan that is Hebraic. Leonard, who is a student of all things, brought a little of that. And an awful lot of intellectualism, you know. Leonard is a very intellectual man. He really, you know, as the books indicate, I am not Spock. No, 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 I am. And the revised book written by Leonard Nimoy, admitting that he is indeed Spock, may be the triumph of what he accomplished in returning to the franchise in To Make Two, and the emotional experience of the death of his character, and this, his own directorial debut, and his rebirth. as a character.
Affirmative, Captain. Our readings are well below danger level.
Very well. Exercise caution, Lieutenant. This landing is Captain's discretion, and I'm the one who's out on a limb.
I'll try to remember that, Captain.
The changeover, or transition, if you will, between Kirstie's portrayal of Savick and my own was really not all that difficult. The reason it wasn't awkward, I believe, was because of the way Leonard Nimoy and Harve Bennett handled it, although I was extremely aware of the fact that I was coming in to play a role that had already been established by someone else. I was never made to feel like that was what was happening. As far as they were concerned, I was here to play a role, and it was the beginning. I literally put myself in Leonard Nimoy's hands at the beginning of the film. He had a very different take on the character than Nicholas Meyer and Kirstie Alley. And I say that because I think of my portrayal as Savick as such a collaboration between the two of us. And he said, "I will not take you out on the end of a limb and leave you hanging there. I will be with you every step of the way." So he was a very gentle, ever-present director.
No, absolutely not, Jim. You're my best officer. But I am Commander Starfleet, so I don't break rules.
Don't quote rules to me. I'm talking about loyalty and sacrifice. One man who's died for us. Another with deep emotional problems.
Now, wait a minute.
I did inherit costumes for the most part. The costumes were designed for Star Trek II. There was no way in the world that the studio was going to authorize a total costume change for Star Trek III for the uniforms. Those were the uniforms. We were going to wear them. And that was okay. Certainly for Star Trek III, it was not a problem for me because I was out of it for the most part. And I don't think I ever did wear the uniform in Star Trek III. I was in a robe for much of the time.
Scotty's help, I can... But no, Jim. The Enterprise would never stand the pounding, and you know it.
I'll find a ship. I'll hire a ship.
Out of the question, my friend. The Council has ordered that no one but the science team goes to Genesis. Jim, your life and your career stand for rationality, not for intellectual chaos. Keep up this emotional behavior and you'll lose everything. You'll destroy yourself. Do you understand me, Jim?
Now, this is a classic kind of hero turning point where the hero is told, regardless of what you feel is the right thing to do, we're telling you you must not do it. And he says, okay, fine, you're right, I get you. And then he goes and does it. Says, the answer is no, I'm therefore going anyway. Cheers in the audience. Yay, that's our guy.
Thank you, Mr. Sulu, I'll need it.
Shall I alert Dr. McCoy?
Please, he has a long journey ahead of him.
I'm Charles Carell. I was the director of photography on Star Trek III. The sequence opens up with two people playing like a video game with two airplanes chasing each other around. There was a perfect example. ILM was heavily involved with that, and I had to use a tremendous amount of exposure, but yet at the same time, not making it look overlit, so that it has that kind of bar feeling. I originally wanted to put smoke in there also to give it kind of, a bar feeling. But because of the ILM elements that were involved, you have to be very careful when you shoot plates. You can't have moving elements like smoke and stuff like that because there's no control over it. So in the extended dialogue between McCoy and the alien, we used lighting that came up from the tables, and it was all very natural lighting. We had tables made that had fluorescent tubes in them so that we'd have some sort of different feeling in the bar, as opposed to just lighting traditionally, like 10 or 12 tables, and the bar itself, although it's not in the picture for any length of time, the bar itself all had fluorescent tubes going along it, so that all the lighting sort of had this up feel, which tends to make, it gives it a little spooky feeling and makes the aliens look a little more dangerous than just traditionally being lit.
How soon is now? How much is where?
I was looking for some way to energize it and make it fresh and exciting and interesting, and in the first go-around, the whole thing broke out into a big fight when they were trying to take McCoy into custody, and one thing led to another, and drinks were thrown, and a fist fight started, and it just didn't work. It just didn't feel right, and I couldn't execute it successfully. There wasn't enough time, wasn't enough money, and but this was a wonderful performance by Alan Miller here, this great alien character.
Right, damn it, it's Genesis. The name of the place we're going is Genesis.
Genesis?
Yes, Genesis. How can you be deaf with ears like that?
Genesis aloud is not...
The language was backward, in reverence to Yoda, I suppose, at the time.
Genesis.
But he made something wonderful out of it.
I'm damn well.
We wrote a line for him when he was on set.
Sir, I'm sorry.
He had these gigantic elephant ears. And so I gave D, I said, D, don't you think we ought to take advantage of the ears? And we came up with the line, how can you be deaf with ears like that? And he got a little titter, but looking at him on the set, it was hysterical. He looked like Dumbo.
Federation security, sir.
I always felt that it made sense for us. It was good movie making, good Star Trek movie making, to give each of these characters a moment that identified them and personified their being in the movie, their what they were all about, to give us a sense that they really existed, flesh and blood, for a moment here and there. So they weren't totally background people, and for the actors too, for their own sense of making a contribution. Give them a chance to play a moment, to play a scene, to play a line, something that says, I'm here, and this is how I stand on this issue. You know? I thought it was very important to do that.
What's going on down there?
I must say, I think when I started out to make this movie, I think all of the cast, without exception, were really curious about, what is Nimoy doing here? How did he get this job, and why did he get this job, and what makes him think he can do this, you know? And what's it going to mean to us? Here's an actor. Suddenly he's now the boss, you know. Does that mean that he's going to take over and become the big star here? And does that mean we're all going to get short shrift? I don't know what they were thinking. I didn't ask them. But I did sense definitely that I was on trial with everybody. And it took a scene or two here or there for them to begin to understand that I knew what their comfort levels were and what they needed in order to play well and to work comfortably and well. And that I really cared. I really cared. I thought it was terribly important. If these people come off well, the movie's going to come off well. You know?
With the prisoner.
So I think I earned their trust, finally. By the time we got to four, the Star Trek 4, I think we had an entirely different atmosphere. Yeah. But there was a lot of testing going on here. You know, you want me to go there? Why? You know, you want me to sit on this line? Really? Why? Well, because... Well, this is his heroic moment. He makes it possible for them to get away.
He's on the way up.
Don't call me Tidings.
In this picture, actually, the entire concept was a comedy adventure sequence. At the same time, we were having fun with the problem of obsolescence of Enterprise and so on. And may I tell you my favorite line in the picture? After years in television and fending off censors, Bridge, and he says, oh, and we're planning to surpass all the speed records of Enterprise. And he says, yeah, gets in the elevator, and the elevator voice says,
level, please.
Transporter room.
And he says,
up your shaft.
I laugh still when I see that. Roger. I said, gee, I can say anything I want to now that I'm in feature pictures.
You amaze me, Commander.
Oh, how is that?
A 20-year space veteran, yet you choose the worst duty station in town. I mean, look at this place. This is the hind end of space.
Peace and quiet appeals to me, Lieutenant.
Yeah, well, maybe that's okay for someone like you, whose career is winding down. But me, I need some challenge in my life, some adventure, maybe even just a surprise or two.
Well, you know what they say, Lieutenant. Be careful.
There's a line in the picture called, in the Uhura scene. Mr. Adventure says to Uhura, I don't understand. You're a veteran of space, and you're stuck here in the hind end of space.
God.
good Mr. Dream. Adventure says, what? You lost all no sense of reality? And she says, this isn't reality.
I'm not gonna do
this
anything.
Is fantasy. That does pop out of the picture. And I've always felt awkward about his setup line. Have you lost all your sense of reality? Doesn't sound like an English language sentence to me in retrospect. But I wanted to set up her line as a kind of ode to the whole business of science fiction movies. Because it is fantasy. And she's acknowledging that. I also wanted to give Uhura her moment in the sun, and she played it well.
Mr. Adventure eating out of my hand, sir. And I'll see all of you at the rendezvous. Oh, and Admiral, all my hopes.
And this to me is the great scene where all of the heroes say, we're part of this, we're going, you can't stop us, don't try to get rid of us, don't try to do this alone, we're going with you. And it shows the loyalty, the camaraderie of the Star Trek crew, which I think is a big, big factor in the Star Trek saga, and their professionalism, their degree of commitment to getting the job done. It's the loyalty scene.
Mr. Scott? I'd be grateful, Admiral, if you'd give the word.
Gentlemen, may the wind be at our backs. Station, please.
In lighting the bridge of the Enterprise, all we used was exterior lights coming in from the doors. Then as they come in, there's a dark bridge, the monitors start coming on, and then I had a ring light above where Kirk sits in the main panel that lights up as they all take their positions. I tried as much as I could in that picture to keep the walls sort of subdued so that the monitors really took some sort of presence.
Commander Starfleet on emergency channel. He orders you to surrender this vessel.
No reply, Chekov.
Aye, sir.
Steady as you go, sir.
Yellow alert. Captain to the bridge. Yellow alert.
Bridge, this is the captain. How can you have a yellow alert in space dock?
Sir, someone is stealing the Enterprise.
I'm on my way.
Alert, yellow alert.
This gentleman playing the janitor as Enterprise goes out of space dock is Charles Correll. Charles Correll was our cinematographer, but he wanted to act, and he said, okay, you be the janitor in this scene.
Are you just going to walk through?
Harv and I had a lot of conversation about the fact that when the Enterprise comes limping home, the people who see it in that holding room, that waiting room where they're looking through the windows, should have some sense that this is a paying ship. We should be investing it with some kind of humanity, some kind of emotion.
Moorings retracted. All speeds available through.
And even now, they take this ship out and. As beat up as it is, we're going to say this ship, with the ingenuity of our engineer Scotty, is going to beat the Excelsior at its own game. I mean, the Excelsior is going to come charging out and say, "Ah, oh, come on, that little beat up little thing out there, we're going to have it in no time." And what happens is the good old tried and trusty true Enterprise, with its clever crew, including the engineer Scotty, is going to beat this very slick, gigantic new thing with its pompous attitude. It's the little guy versus the big guy, you know, and the little guy wins because we like the little guy.
The budget problems in Star Trek III were different than II. We were still faced with keep it low, keep it within a certain range, $10 to $13 million at that time, I believe. We had certain advantages now. We had a revised bridge. We had new graphics which came in, which made shooting time a lot easier and the displays a lot more sophisticated than the prior bridges in II or certainly the series.
Full impulse power.
Aye, sir.
Jim Sicking is a wonderful, wonderful actor and a good friend. And he and Harve Bennett go way back and have a long history of working together. And he was Harve Bennett's idea, and a wonderful idea. He brought a certain kind of smugness and a certain kind of attitude to this thing where you just wanted to see him lose, you know, see him get egg in the face. Somebody says to me, oh, you can't use Jim Sicking, he's Hill Street Blues. I say, oh, yeah? Watch this. He's a good actor, and he's going to pull it off, and he did. Same thing with Chris Lloyd. Talk to me about typecasting, you know. Oh, you can't do that. You know. I'm the wrong guy for anybody to say to. Oh, but they'll be thinking of Taxi. Or they'll be thinking of Hill Street Blues. Don't talk to me about that stuff, man. I mean, you know, I have done a lot of other work outside of Star Trek, and people, nobody has said, oh, he shouldn't be doing that, or he couldn't do that, or he was wrong doing that. It's a fear that certain people have in our industry, that there will be this identification, it'll create a problem for you. I don't have that fear. I must not let myself have that fear. I must believe that although I'm strongly identified with Spock, I'm still capable of playing other characters, and I think I've done it fairly successfully.
What I'm getting at is the way the budget was redistributed, and we spent more on ILM visuals. We worked once again with ILM. Ken Ralston, the Oscar-winning maven of such things, was our supervisor. We needed something marvelous for the death of Enterprise. We needed special effects for Space Dock and Excelsior. We needed Vulcan and the size thereof. We needed a bird of prey and much more and destruction, and there's just a couple of space battles. We had certain advantages because now we had a set, and the script itself and the Genesis Planet concept could be played out on one soundstage. Jack Chilberg's set was incredible in that, as it is described in the film, every climate known to man is all there on one planet, which is a small planet. A large set, but a small planet.
This is scary stuff to shoot. You're shooting on a soundstage in Hollywood, and you've got this white stuff that they've sort of chopped out of various kinds of paper and foam and what have you, and you've got the wind machine blowing, and you're trying desperately to sell the idea that you're on a planet that's going totally crazy, and it's scary. Is it going to be believable? Are people going to believe that they're in snow, you know? And we didn't have the money or the time to go out to some vista someplace where it really was snowing to get some master shots that would help set it up. It was all had to be contained right here on the stage. And hopefully it works, you know. We just keep shooting and shooting and trying various ways to make it feel cold and make it feel like it's real. And you got this little boy and he's supposed to look like me. You know, you got a lot of nervous-making elements here, hoping that they'll come together and make sense.
Savick, that's extraordinary. What would you like to do next?
Request permission to beam aboard immediately.
I have not done research on terraforming. The idea came to me full-blown, presented by Harve and writers that he was working with and whoever he was discussing those things with, and they, since they had been involved in the creation of the Genesis planet in Star Trek II, I inherited that as a given. And then when the idea came up that it was an imperfect creation, that it was going to degenerate, that gave us a ticking time bomb in this story that we had to beat. We've got to save Spock before the Genesis planet destroys itself. So that gave us some dramatic conflict to work against.
An energy surge. Locate.
Surge from astern, Captain. God.
This was reconstructed from something else, and I frankly don't remember what it was. It was originally in some other movie, and they said, will this work as the Klingon bridge? And I had to say yes. It was a question of money. It was a question of it'll cost X number of dollars, and we can afford, if we can do this, we can afford to make this work. We have the money to make this, if you can dress this as the Klingon bridge. And it was very cramped, very difficult, but we managed to do it.
Sir, may I suggest...
Say the wrong thing, Torg!
If it's risen as you want, there are life signs on the planet. Perhaps the very scientist you seek.
Very good.
We actually had four actors who played Spock, and this is Carl Stevens, the youngest version of Spock, and he was just a delight to work with. Young, but so available, and you know, and willing to play with us, you know, and that's really what doing Star Trek is. Frankly, it's, you know, can you come out and play with time?
Can we hold speed, Scotty?
Nice. She's got her second wind now.
Scan for vessels in pursuit.
Scanning. Indications negative at this time.
Did I get it right?
Great, Bones, just great.
Merritt has such playfulness in him, and he kept doing things to draw me out. He would offer to dance, to sing, you know, all kinds of fun things, because, you know, as people may not be aware, but a lot of the time on a set is downtime. You're not actually on camera for very long. They spend a lot of time preparing for a shot, and particularly of a film of this nature. So you have a lot of time to rehearse, or to prepare, or to play, or to share, which is why actors often talk about, you know, having formed a family-like connection to other people, because there's all that time. And Merritt was just such a generous, forthcoming, willing, playful person. And I thank God that by the end he broke down my sort of, you know, I'm here to do serious work exterior, and got me to sing and to dance in between takes and to just enjoy myself. And that meant so much to me. And I was very, very sad when he died. The world lost a very talented actor and a very good human being.
This is a morality tale about scientific ethics, about how quickly can science move, how quickly should science move, what are the dangers of science moving too quickly. One of the things that we were curious about in the 60s and 70s and 80s with the advent of atomic warfare and hydrogen warfare, is science getting ahead of civilization and will we destroy ourselves as a result? Or, I mean, what's going to control what? Is science going to control civilization or vice versa? And here was a case of a scientist who got ambitious and allowed his ambition to get in the way of his judgment and created a dangerous idea as a result. Four young guys at various ages. One of them, as I recall, had blue eyes, so we gave him contact lenses because he looked enough like me that we wanted him to do the job, but we had to color his eyes. And this whole idea that this is Spock as a child, it's tough to pull off. To this day, I wonder if we stretched the audience's credibility too far, but I guess it worked. I think the whole idea was rooted in the condition of the planet itself. The planet itself is aging very quickly. So we're saying, well, if there's an embryo Spock in there, then it'll be aging very quickly. And over a period of a couple of hours of film time, it's going to age to the point where Leonard Nimoy steps in, and there he is, Spock full grown. You know, that was the story we decided to tell. Now it became a question of whether or not we could successfully execute it and make an audience believe it and care about it. That's the question of cloning, isn't it? It's a question of taking some genetic material out of there. And whatever it is, it's a question of whatever it is that is the science that created the planet takes Spock's genetic material and recreates him, makes a clone of him. So in a sense, you could say this is Spock being cloned. This is a cloning story.
Whoever they are, they're getting closer.
I'll go.
No.
I can't say enough about the ensemble cast, and by that I mean the original series cast members. I'm speaking about Walter Koenig, George Takei, Mark Leonard, Nichelle Nichols, DeForest Kelly, James Doohan, just wonderful people, and I include in that as well Leonard and Bill, of course. They each extended themselves to me in the kindest way. You know, several of them were really crucial in sort of explaining all of that to me and making me realize that was some place I could go. You know, when I was first invited to a convention, I said to my representatives, who would want me to go anywhere to talk about anything? I mean, who am I? I'm nobody. And they made me understand that if they want you to come and they want to hear what you have to say, you're somewhat obligated to go, and it's a fun experience, it's a good experience, and you'll enjoy it, and you won't feel as though you've let them down, like you're not enough to bring. And I've just enjoyed that experience enormously in the last 18 years, 19 years.
At regular intervals.
It is called Ponfar. Ponfar.
And here we come to the scene where it's always been, in my understanding, that Vulcans come into Ponfar once every 7 years. And this being approximately his 14th year of age, I would say to myself, I said to the writers and the producers, we've got to have a scene where Spock is going through this Ponfar experience for the first time. And she recognizes it. She knows what it is. He doesn't have any idea what's happening to him. All he knows is that he's struggling. And she knows what it's going to take to calm this adolescent young guy and relieve him of the anguish he's going through, which is adolescence, going through the stages of adolescence that we all go through. And with a Vulcan, it's pretty severe stuff. But we've never actually seen this sort of ceremony before, this sort of mating ritual, these hands stroking, and it's foreplay. We're watching foreplay here. Studio was very nervous about this scene. They said, oh, people will probably be laughing. And I said, no, they won't. They'll be very curious about what this is all about and where's it going.
We are secured from warp speed. Now entering Genesis Sector. Proceed at impulse power.
I think one of my biggest concerns and challenges while making this picture was to make sure that the makeup and the prosthetics that were applied to the actors always looked believable. And sometimes they'd come in and you could still see, no matter how good the makeup artists were, you know, little lines and hair nets and stuff like that. So sometimes, because of those applications, it dictated the way I had to light them. Now, on the Klingon ship, we were lucky because we had all this top light, and I think we accomplished what we had to do. And we tried to keep it dark also to give it that ominous feeling. But that was a huge challenge, to make sure that all those applications really took on a believable feeling to the audience.
There was something there, sir.
What did you see?
For an instant, a scout-class vessel.
Could be Grissom. Patch in a hailing frequency.
Grissom, this is Enterprise calling. Please come in.
This set was our most elaborate set. It was a full sound stage. It was a stage on which Cecil B. DeMille many years ago shot The Parting of the Red Sea in his biblical epics. And it had a false floor so you could get underneath and build stuff down underneath there. And the physical special effects people actually built in trap doors in the floor of this set, which would open up and fire could erupt out of there.
A failure.
So that when we come down to the crucial moments later, where the planet is really going, this whole thing turns into a fire pit. And it was a complex set. I think very well done, very well executed. I think it worked very well. But tough to build and tough to shoot.
You enjoy.
Joe, quick! I order no interruptions.
But, sir, Federation starship approaching.
Bring me up.
Grissom, this is Enterprise calling. Do you read?
Grissom, this is Enterprise calling. Please come in.
Shooting of these guys on the Klingon bridge was all about getting in tight, getting mysterious, getting intense. Very tight, very up close, intense stuff to emphasize the power of them, the presence of them, the danger of them, and their conspiratorial attitude, their whispering, and the tension that grew out of that. Worst comes to shove, what are we going to do? How do we figure this out? How do we maneuver here? It's a chess game. How do we play this game? Who fires first? Who sees who? Cat and mouse, try to mislead him, try to anticipate him.
Great.
And here's Chris Lloyd in all his glory, really working it, you know. Working it good. And our guys working it good.
Range, 2,000 kilograms.
Stand by to transfer energy to weapons. At my command.
There. That distortion, see it?
Yes, sir. It's getting larger as we close in.
Firing range, sir.
The Klingon makeup started very economically. It was dark skin, facial hair, eyebrows, and that was about it. It was something you could put on in 20 minutes. These days, the Klingon makeups are taking several hours to put on. They just have evolved into this very complex series of head pieces and nose pieces and jaw pieces and all kinds of physical changes that they put these actors through. Very time-consuming and very expensive.
All power to the weapon systems.
In the television series, it was simply dark skin and a mustache and a little bit of a beard and some eyebrows.
My guess is right.
The more makeup you put on the guy, the more powerful the performance has to be to crack through it. No question. Otherwise, you just lose any kind of living entity in there behind all that plastic.
Klingon bird of prey, sir. She's arming torpedoes.
Fire, Mr. Scott.
Yeah, the bird of prey was was a homeless bird there, in a sense, being used by multicultures. But I think what we wanted to do was establish it clearly as a Klingon because of its evil-looking nature and its name, the bird of prey. They had a lot of fun designing that one. And I think the color selection, kind of serpentine, kind of green, went on to help us enormously, not only there, but later we utilized it in Star Trek IV because it is so dramatic a look.
Emergency!
emergency power. Prepare to return fire. Can you transfer power to the theater, man?
I don't think so, sir.
What happened?
They've knocked out the automation center.
When I was given the job, Michael Eisner, head of Paramount, said to me when it was, yes, you're going to do it, he said, make it theatrical. Three words. What do those three words mean, make it theatrical? What they mean is, make it feel like something other than a TV show. So you're looking to create as much size and scope as possible. Difficult when you're in a very, very, very tight budget. So you've got to look for opportunities to give it size and give it... give it shape that's beyond the small screen.
Truce to confer. Put them on screen.
In New York, in what was then the Gulf and Western building, it's now Trump Tower or something like that, at Columbus Circle. And it was a test screening, and Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner, who had hired me to do the movie, were there. I had had my go-arounds with Michael, as I told you. He actually believed that I had, in my contract at the end of Star Trek II, that Spock had to die in that movie. He thought I wanted to be done with Star Trek and hated it. And that was not true, and I had to educate him to that fact. So here we were now, the movie's finished, and we're in New York for the first screening. We go upstairs to a waiting lounge where there are maybe 30 or 40 of us people. What we're waiting for is for the review cards to come up. The audience is filling out cards. I liked the picture. I didn't like the picture. I would recommend it. I would not recommend it. I liked this character. I didn't like this character. That kind of thing. And they tabulate these things, and they come up with a score. You know. So we're waiting. We're waiting upstairs. I wasn't really tense about it. I thought it was going to do well. I thought it was going to be okay. I know the audience pretty well. It's not like we're trying out a whole new thing here called Star Trek. Been around for a while. I find myself standing back to back with Michael Eisner. I'm talking to somebody, and he's talking to somebody, and we're back to back. And I overhear this person saying to Michael Eisner, how did you decide to give him the job to direct this movie? And I hear Michael Eisner say to this guy, he told me he was going to direct this movie, or I could go f*** myself.
Yes, he is. And someone else.
Those were his words, you know, because he wanted me in the picture. He wanted me to act in the movie. And I turned around and said, Michael, I never said that. No. He said, you're right, you're right. He was always a perfect gentleman. He didn't use those exact words. That's what I remember about the first screening. And then the numbers came up, and it was terrific, and everybody was happy, and we all went out and celebrated.
Savick's right. This planet is unstable. It's going to destroy itself in a matter of hours.
David, what went wrong?
I went wrong.
I don't understand.
I'm sorry, sir. Just don't surrender. Genesis doesn't work. I can't believe they'd kill us for it.
Admiral, your young friend is mistaken. I meant what I said. And now to show that my intentions are sincere, I shall kill one of the prisoners.
This was challenging for me. I'd never shot a sequence like this before. First time I'd ever done it. Suspense, danger, fear, surprise. All of these potential emotions. What are the pieces of film necessary to sell the story, to make it scary, to make it work, to see what's really going on here? You had to have sizable, dramatic, emotional events take place. And one of them would be the death of Kirk's son. And I went along with it. I thought it makes dramatic sense in terms of the operatic form that I talked about.
Savick. David.
Admiral. David is dead.
Bill stepped backward in a rehearsal. And I honestly don't know to this day whether he stumbled back accidentally or that he intended to do it. But when it happened, it was so touching and so poignant to see Captain Kirk fall like that, lose his balance and fall in this clumsy kind of sad way in this powerful, poignant moment. We both decided it was absolutely right and let's do it. It was daring for him. You know, it's degrading for the character. This normally powerful, always pulled together kind of guy suddenly loses control. and then rises to the occasion and comes back to fight. So we both felt it was right, and I think it was.
Surrender your vessel.
All right, Daniel. All right. Give me a minute to inform my crew.
I give 2 minutes for you and your gallant crew. Take every last man, form a boarding party armed heavily.
I have to thank Nicholas Meyer, my more than collaborator on Star Trek II, my inspiration, and he who contributed so much. Nick brought a kind of incipient kind of, you know, let's have fun with this thing. And my task was, wait a minute, I've got to represent the orthodoxy here. I've got to protect Star Trek fans. We can't step over certain lines. And he would say, why not? And we would argue that throughout the making of Star Trek II. And so from Nick, I got a boldness that, as the inheritor of the task on Star Trek II, I didn't really have. Now, I could say lines like, up your shaft. I could play the comedy in the escape sequence. And not feel I was breaking the barriers of the Star Trek franchise, which was, I know it sounds funny, but I felt a deep responsibility to the fans. They are a powerful lobby. They had at that time, there was no internet at that time, but there was a fanzine network, which is now an internet network. And the slightest move in the world of Star Trek became noted, and letters were written, and the studio was quite sensitive to many of them. We went through an issue on this picture that was exactly parallel to the Death of Spock issue on Star Trek II. Someone leaked that Enterprise was going to be destroyed. Well, my gosh, that was our secret climax. And the letter campaign on that was not nearly as significant as the Spock thing. Nobody seemed to believe that. And that was a great relief to us because plot-wise, we wanted the surprise. Lo and behold, 2 weeks before release of the picture, the trailer department comes in and says, here's the studio's approved trailer for your movie. I said, oh, okay. Lynn and I sat there, and it says, The Death of Enterprise! Boom! And we almost cried. We said, how can you do this to us? We argued, and we fought, and we lost. One of those conflicts between art and commerce where the artist loses. And did it hurt us in the end? Not commercially, but artistically, there's a feeling as I wish no one had known. And then the full impact of the grief on the crew would have been achieved.
We are energizing transporter beam now.
Transporter, stand by.
It's either the Enterprise and all of us die, or the Enterprise dies. So the choice is pretty clear. Let's use the Enterprise as a weapon against these people and lose the Enterprise and save the day. You know, this is fun to shoot. You know, this sort of classic scene where, you know, they're walking into a trap. They can't quite figure it out until it's too late.
My lord.
There was a lot of outcry when word got out that Spock was going to die in Star Trek II. A lot of outcry. I was in China working on the Marco Polo miniseries when I picked up the Asian edition of the Wall Street Journal. And I picked it up because it was one of the few English language newspapers you could find in China at the time. And there was a front page picture of me as Spock and a front page story in the Wall Street Journal. Fans claim Paramount will lose $18 million if Spock dies. And they went through this whole story about how the fans had written these petitions and letters to Paramount to to try to prevent the death of Spock, saying we won't go to see the movie four or five times, we won't buy the video, we won't buy the paraphernalia, we won't buy the Mercury, you know, protesting the potential death of Spock. It became a news event. So here we are going to destroy the Enterprise. You know, it's science fiction. There's always possibilities. So you go to the extreme, you do the thing that everybody is scared to do, creates drama, and then you find a way to rebuild out of it. Hopefully. Hopefully you can find a way to recover. That's the big canvas. The big operatic moment where the music swells and you see these guys up there like a bunch of space heroes watching this amazing event fly across the sky, burning.
A fighting chance to live.
Planet core readings unstable, changing rapidly.
What about surface life signs?
There.
Some of the crew members would come up to me very stealthily, you know, and kind of say, you know, I like those ears. You look good in those ears. I mean, some, you know, they were sweet. Some of the guys implied that they were a little bit of a turn on. However, I was lectured that I could not wear them home. There was a very strict regimen. You had to have them taken off because very harsh chemicals removed them. And then at home, I was instructed to sort of lather them in Neosporin every night to keep them from the skin from breaking, because if it had, that might have caused all kinds of problems in terms of infection, and the various glues and chemicals that they use to keep them on and then take them off would irritate any kind of opening in the skin. So, boy, I was given a stern talking to about how to maintain those ears at night. So Kirstie Alley sort of got away with murder if she wore her ears home. I'm sort of jealous she got away with it, but I hope she had fun.
One of the trades, dramatically, in the script is Enterprise will come back. It was our intention somehow, some way, to replace it. Because it's a replaceable item. One cannot replace the original, but one can certainly find a way in the next film, and we did, to restore it to these people so they would be, once again, with, you know, O1A.
What happened?
But someone paid a price, and that was the death of Kirk's son. So the price of the movie is, in personal terms, is Kirk, having just found he has a son, loses him in this particular endeavor. And Sarek says so near the end, but at what cost? Your ship, your son. And frankly, the ship is replaceable, the son is not. Remember that Sarek is a Vulcan. And he's already come as close as he can come to being a father. In that, when he says, my logic is uncertain where my son is concerned.
Klingon Commander.
So,
this is Admiral James T. Kirk.
It could be that son should come before ship. But maybe he's trying to be logical again.
Our ship was the victim of an unfortunate accident. Sorry about your crew, but as we say on Earth, c'est la vie. I have what you want. I have the secret of Genesis. You're going to have to bring us up there to get it. You hear me? I'm waiting for you. What is your answer?
When we were shooting this picture, we had just moved into the largest stage at Paramount, which is Stage 15. And this is where they built the Genesis planet, the big forest and all the effects for the earthquake, and all of that was placed in there. I still had kind of a bug about not being able to go to Kauai because I still thought it would look much better as an exterior. So lo and behold, we start shooting the Genesis planet, and a huge fire breaks out at Paramount. And the back lot at Paramount happened to butt up against this stage. And the stage almost burnt down. And if I can be just a little cynical about this right now, I was thinking, my God, I'm going to get my wish. We're going to end up going to Kauai because this place is going to burn down and we won't be able to use it. But through the efforts of a lot of people on the lot, in fact, a lot of people in the cast and crew went out to help fight the fire. I think Bill Shatner himself was out there. They were able to save the stage, although a part of the exterior wall had caught fire and there were huge holes in it. So we had to put up these huge black curtains to keep the sunlight from coming out. In a way, that would have been a major disaster because looking back on it now, there was just no other way to do it. We couldn't have gone outside. We would have had to keep everything on stages because at the end of the film, again, the planet kind of comes apart and all that, and that's all special effects, and it has to be done under controlled situations. And on a stage, that's the only way to do it. I was in my office on the day of the fire. I could see the stage from my second story window, and my first awareness was sirens and clangs. By the time I got there, everything was under control, and Bill Shatner grabbed a garden hose and appeared on television saying, "Everything's under control, the fire will be put out." And if Kirk says it, it came to pass, with a little help from LAFD. And he was, you know, it was terrific for the picture that this reality had brought was brought to the attention of all our fans worldwide. Fire threatens Star Trek. Shatner to the rescue. Good. When it came to shooting the planet breaking up, this was probably the most difficult part of the shoot. Not only for me, but for the actors, the stuntmen, the special effects people. As you know, the ground separates, fire shoots up, and whenever you deal with fire, you're dealing with smoke. And what we did to try and keep on scheduling as quickly and as effectively as possible is, of course, we used multiple cameras everywhere. I had mentioned earlier that I had used 9 cameras on different scenes. Well, the scenes involving the planet breaking up, I had to use, this is where I used 9 cameras. So we tried to get as much as we could and take one, because if we have to go back and reset, they'd have to open up all the doors, blow out all the smoke, reset the effects, and basically close up the floor again so it didn't look like it had separated. And this sometimes could take maybe 2.5 hours. So the multiple cameras there were the thing that really saved us a lot, especially when it came to using our actual cast. It was a very, very extensive job. It was an amazing special effects job because they literally had all sorts of portions, trees that would collapse and the earth would separate, and fire would shoot up, and they had this spread out almost over a block. Normally this type of sequence would have taken 3 months, and I think we did it in about 3 weeks. So that was the biggest challenge.
No. Peace. That or nothing.
If I read this right, sir, we have full power.
Go, sir.
We are clear and free to navigate.
Best speed to Vulcan. Mr. Chekhov, take the prisoner below.
Aye, sir.
Wait! You said you would kill me.
I lied.
You know, when I first appeared as Spock in Star Trek, all of the conversation was about pointer ears. It was all about pointer ears. Oh, you got pointer ears. Oh, look at the pointer ears, pointer ears, pointer ears. Wherever there was a press reference, it was he of the pointed ears, Spock with the pointed ears, you know, and that gradually just went away. Finally, after years, it took time. But then the point of view became something else. It became, what's happening with these people? Who are they? What are they doing? What are they experiencing? What do we learn from them? What do we know about them? What do we like about them? What don't like about them? And the whole makeup thing goes away finally, you know. That's not what it's about anymore.
Tell you something that I never thought I'd ever hear myself say. But it seems I've missed you. I don't know if I could stand to lose you again.
Probably the best example of the differing point of view between a writer and a director would be in the Vulcan sequence. Ambassador, for the writer, it is essentially a passive sequence. Permission granted. You know, whatever's happening, you don't dare suggest we depict visually the transference of a Katra from one person to another, because that would be laughable. It all goes on over an extended period of time, from night into dawn.
It's been a while, sir.
And you reach a point where you say, all right, it's going on. Let's move slowly, but let's move on. To the director, the delight of the visuals of Vulcan, really seen, especially by a Vulcan director, to show his homeland and its culture in such rich detail is, it's marvelous. And Leonard did it marvelously. Probably the only location we used in this whole picture was a staircase at Occidental College, which was to serve as the main entrance to get up to this sort of Vulcan altar, where the last ceremony takes place. This had to be shot at night, and in order to accommodate the ILM plates and opticals, it required a tremendous amount of exposure. So we had to send away, there was one light that they were using in England at the time, a cinematographer by the name of David Watkins built this huge light for night exteriors, and we actually had to emulate that and build our own. And it was this huge light. It was called the Wendy light, and you have to put it up with a construction crane.
There was a lot of stuff that I wanted to do on that walk up the stairs that I couldn't get. I wanted to get more in touch with the people. I wanted to get in touch with people's reaction to Spock, this legendary person coming home. I don't know if you can see it or if you were ever aware of it, but when those women were carrying the body, I had them simply holding their hands over Spock's body. Not under Spock's body, but over Spock's body. As though they were levitating it. Did you notice that? As though they were levitating the body. I tried everything. I tried all kinds of strange magical touches here. The magic of Vulcan, I always felt I had a big responsibility to try to enhance the magic of the Vulcan people, the Vulcan planet.
Child of Sulkar.
Spock was an important person on the Vulcan planet, and he had died, and now word comes out on the planet that Spock is coming home. They're bringing Spock home, and there's going to be this Captra ritual that hasn't been done in ages. They're going to try to save Spock. It was, to me, a very big culminating scene. And I wanted big acting. I wanted big sets. I wanted a lot of people. I wanted maybe three or four times as many people as we could afford. Crowds, you know.
It is uncertain where my son is concerned.
Who is the keeper of the Katra?
I am. McCoy.
We got Dame Judith Anderson. Dame Judith Anderson, who I had a lot of respect for, and a great theatrical actress who I admired for years. I went to Santa Barbara and talked her into doing this thing. She had been away from movies for some time to play the matriarch of the planet who was going to perform this ritual. I needed somebody with power and magic. And, if this scene, to me, was very important.
But, McCoy, you must now be warned. The danger to thyself is as grave as the danger to Spock. You must make the choice.
I choose the danger.
Here we have an improvement in the script by Dame Judith Anderson, to whom I am always indebted. Bones has a line which is, I accept the risk. Dame Judith, who blessed us by taking the part, called me one day and she said, don't you think, dear boy, the word danger would be more dramatic? I said, yes, I think so. And so she says, danger, and he says, I accept the danger.
Ben, Tval, Navoon.
There should be a sense of history here. There should be a sense of control, a sense of ritual that's not to be violated. We had that in A Mock Time, the episode, that there's a very strong sense of history. There's a strong ritualistic belief in the proper way to do things here, and this is the way we do it on Vulcan. Don't interfere. Don't ask questions. This is what we do. This is who we are. This is what we do. We are secure in our knowledge that this works for us. So in essence, they say, here, we bring Spock and we turn him over to you. Please do what you can. There was a backstory that was created early on, which was that the Vulcan people had always been a warring, terribly emotional race, and they had almost destroyed themselves because of their inability to control their emotions. And when that happened, that was when they decided to make a change, which was to eliminate emotion entirely, rule out emotion, and live by intellect alone. And that was the legacy that Spock was carrying on, was this intellectual approach to living, logical approach to living. So here now, the suspense obviously is, what kind of shape is Spock in? Did it work? Did it not work? We don't know yet.
I'm all right, Jim. What about Spock?
Only time will answer.
He's on his feet, and he seems to be physically okay, but we still don't know whether the whole magic worked. We don't dare ask the lady, did it work? You know, she's not the surgeon. This comes out of the surgery and says everything's going to be okay.
Your ship. Your son.
If I hadn't tried, the cost would have been my soul.
There's an interesting moment coming up when Spock looks at Savick and Savick back at him, and I want to tell you about that. Leonard approached me, and he sort of stepped inside my personal aura. You know how we all have that space around us, that if you step within it, you're now kind of, you're a little close, you're close, and maybe, and now you're, you know, your senses kind of perk up. He said, Robin, how would you feel if you imagine you're on a New York City street and someone you were intimate with and loved dearly that you hadn't seen in a long time is now walking toward you? And I remember a flush rose to my cheeks, and not, believe you me, not much embarrasses me, but certainly Leonard Nimoy had never asked a personal question of me, and I wasn't sure if he actually wanted an answer in that moment. And as our heads now come apart, because he had put his mouth right to my ear to ask me that question, I was attempting to find my words to tell him what that would mean to me. And then I was embarrassed, and so I looked down. And then I came up again because I wanted to give him what he asked of me. And then he said, that's it.
And this set was scary to shoot on. We had nothing. We had that's a painted piece of canvas in the background there. And I had a conversation with the photographer, and I said, look, make it go out of focus, because what it looked like was a painted piece of canvas back there. So you cross your fingers and hope it works, you know. Believe me, there were moments where I was terrified that it was going to look like amateur time. We just didn't have the money to give us security, so you were always skirting the edges, trying to find ways to make it work.
Outweighed the needs of the many.
I can't say enough about Bill Shatner's contribution to Star Trek. I can't say enough about it. There have been times when he's been worked over, fairly or unfairly, for this or that moment or this or that performance. I can't tell you enough about what his contribution meant to making Star Trek work. From the moment he came on the series, after it was decided to recast the series, and he came on after the pilot was done, it all started to cook. And his energy, his bravado, his bravery to try things, to energize things by being big, by being operatic, by being energetic, made it possible for the whole thing to work. And let me also say that the two producers who deserve enormous credit for the history of Star Trek, and I don't think get anywhere near what they deserve, was Gene Kuhn, who was on the series, and Harve Bennett, who took Star Trek, which was a beached whale after Star Trek I, and put it back in the water and made it float with Star Trek II, and got us going again, where it was in danger of just floundering and dying. Now, the history works for you there. The history between the two characters is what's working for you in that exchange of looks.
If the instinct is right, there's going to be tears, there's going to be joy, and now we're adding hope to that by saying, and the adventure continues. In a way, it was a reward to the loyal audience that had supported us so well through two movies so far. Three movies, really. But certainly the two that I had anything to do with.
My name is not mentioned until the end of the movie here in the end credits. I'm not in the opening credit of the movie.
It was interesting. When they went to do the advertising campaign, they had my name in the campaign, you know, starring William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. And I said, you can't do that. You can't put my name out there starring William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy in The Search for Spock. You give away the whole ending of the movie, you know. I'm Leonard Nimoy, and I've really enjoyed talking here with you, visiting with you to talk about Star Trek III, and the next thing you know, we'll be talking about Star Trek IV in the same way, and my buddy Bill Shatner will be joining me.